From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember Gretchen Worden, director of the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, a museum of deformities, pathologies, and medical anomalies. She transformed the Mutter from a little-known eccentric collection into a museum with a worldwide reputation, where visitors could revel in its freakish and oddly beautiful exhibits. Worden died Monday at age 57. We listened back to a 2002 interview with her and talk with one of her colleagues, Dr. Mark Hochberg. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new crime drama Collateral, starring Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer. The major stock indexes were all down sharply today after this morning's weak jobs report. The Labor Department said just 32,000 jobs were created in July, far fewer than economists had expected. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The overall unemployment rate fell from 5.6 to 5.5%, but the more closely watched payroll numbers showed an anemic job market. Not only were the July numbers low, but the already disappointing June numbers were also revised downward. Economist Lynn Reeser of Bank of America Capital Management said the numbers show that companies curtailed their hiring in July.
Companies probably actually have been somewhat concerned about some of the signs of slowdown in the economy, the pullback of the stock market over the past month, and the increase in oil prices.
The weak jobs report could slow the Federal Reserve's push to raise interest rates, and bond rates fell sharply. Stock prices also plunged. The major stock indexes are now lower than they were when the year began. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
President Bush defended his economic record today, but he also said there's more work to do on the economy.
Today's employment report shows our economy is continuing to move forward. And it reminds us that we're in a changing economy and we've got more to do. I'm not going to be satisfied until everybody who wants to work can find a job.
Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry says there's been a net loss of more than a million jobs since President Bush took office. There's new controversy involving an attack ad against Kerry. One of Kerry's critics appeared to recant his charges, but then withdrew the recantation. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
The ad consists of 13 veterans of the Navy's Vietnam Swift Boat Fleet accusing Kerry of exaggerating his war record, betraying his comrades, and dishonoring his country. It comes from a group called Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, with financing from a few well-placed Texas Republicans. In the ad, Kerry's former commander, George Elliott, says Kerry has not been honest about Vietnam. Then Elliott did an apparent reversal. He told the Boston Globe that he wished he hadn't signed an affidavit alleging that Kerry embellished his combat record. But by Friday afternoon, the Swift Boat Veterans ad group quoted Elliott as saying the ad should keep on running. Kerry said the ad is politics and he wouldn't let it bother him. Meanwhile, his lawyers warned TV stations that they considered the ad false and libelous. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
In Iraq, a Marine commander says 300 militiamen have been killed in fierce clashes, mostly in the Iraqi city of Najaf. Two Marines were killed yesterday in Najaf. On Wall Street, the Dow lost 147 points today to close at 9,815 in heavy trading. This is NPR. Illinois Republicans are planning a rally in suburban Chicago Sunday to welcome former presidential hopeful Alan Keyes as their candidate for U.S. Senate. Party sources say they have every indication that the conservative activist and former ambassador will accept the nomination. From Chicago Public Radio, Lynette Kalsnes reports.
After several candidates turned them down, Illinois Republicans picked Maryland resident Alan Keyes. Illinois State Senator Steve Rauschenberger previously turned down the nomination. He says Keyes' selection is inspired.
In selecting Alan Keyes, we bring another Harvard-educated, very well-spoken African-American to this race. And it's now not a question any longer of a black United States senator. Now it's simply a question of electing the best United States senator from Illinois.
The Illinois Republican Party tapped Keyes to replace primary winner Jack Ryan, who dropped out after embarrassing sexual allegations were made public. Keyes will face Democratic State Senator Barack Obama. He will have to establish residency in Illinois by Election Day. For NPR News, I'm Lynette Kalsnes in Chicago.
In Chicago today, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made his first public comments on the 9/11 Commission reports. Rumsfeld told the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations that he supports the creation of an intelligence czar, but the devil is in the details. Rumsfeld would have to give up some power over the Pentagon's intelligence agencies if a national intelligence director post were created. NATO warships started patrolling international waters off Greece today as part of security preparations for the Olympics. 7 NATO vessels are monitoring sea traffic. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Gretchen Worden, the longtime director of the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, died Monday at age 57. The Mutter is a museum affiliated with the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. It exhibits tumors, lesions, spinal malformations, Siamese twins, and other deformities, pathologies, and medical anomalies. Although it was created for medical students, it also is open to the public and attracts many people who are interested in observing the mysteries of the human body. Gretchen Worden had been associated with the museum for almost 30 years. It was the only place she had ever worked. And she transformed an eccentric, little-known collection into a destination for thousands of visitors curious to see its freakish and oddly beautiful objects. In 2002, Worden compiled a book of photos of the exhibitions. Many of the photographs were taken by artists who, Worden said, were not interested in conventional beauty, but wanted to explore its opposite, the deformed, the broken, the disfigured bodies of those who suffered congenital abnormality, trauma, or destructive disease. Worden noted in her book, "While these bodies may be ugly, there's a terrifying beauty in the spirits of those forced to endure those afflictions." Terry Gross spoke with Gretchen Worden in 2002. Terry asked her to explain the original reason the Mutter Museum collected these medical abnormalities.
It began as a museum of pathological anatomy, and it was based on the collections of Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter, who was a professor of surgery at Jefferson Medical College here in Philadelphia, 1841 to 56. And at that time, it was the way you taught medicine from actual specimens and models. And so its primary purpose was for the education of medical students.
So it wasn't uncommon then to collect and preserve diseased organs or to make plaster casts of deformities.
Oh, absolutely not. No, the idea of preserving both normal anatomical bodies and pathological specimens goes back hundreds of years before that.
I guess there weren't really good photographs yet?
Photographs didn't come along until 1839. That was when the first daguerreotype was produced. And so it was much more practical at that time if you wanted the teaching specimen to either preserve it in fluid or dry it out or reproduce it as a wax model or a plaster cast.
Now, why are they exhibited now? These aren't used to teach anymore, right?
Oh, we're still very educational. Only the audience has changed.
Right.
We're part of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, which is a private medical society that was founded in 1787. And it has a tremendous medical historical library, the fourth largest in the country. And the museum collection was seen as a complement to the information in the library for the benefit primarily, when it was acquired by the college, of the members of the college and their professional colleagues. But the public was always welcomed ever since it became part of the college in 1863. And it simply is a fact that today most of our visitors are from the general lay public, not people with medical backgrounds. But they're seeing the same materials that were collected and used to educate physicians in a previous century.
I want to talk about some of the specimens that are in the Mutter Museum. And let's start with a plaster cast of a French woman's head with a horn growing out of the forehead. Who is this person and what's happened to her head?
Actually, it's a wax model. The woman, as far as we know, was known as Madame Dimanche, which has been translated as the Widow Sunday. And she was an 80-year-old washerwoman living in Paris. And she'd actually had some previous growths of this type. It's called cornucutaneum. It's a horny substance in the skin that starts overgrowing and producing these excrescences. And in this case, it happened to be a spectacular growth coming out of her forehead. And the model that we have shows it about 6 inches long. The reports, there's a published report in an 1851 journal that describes it as being, by that time, 9 or 10 inches long. And she had to support it in a sack sewn onto her nightcap until she finally got to the doctor and had it taken off.
How do you live with a horn growing out of your forehead for so long?
Well, I keep telling people, even today, people put off going to the doctor. And I think we all have a little reluctance. Back then, there was less that a doctor could do for you, so the hesitation was natural. That's one of the biggest questions. People look at her and wonder, how can you let it grow so long? And I point out that she was a washerwoman, and this is someone who takes in laundry. She probably was not dealing with the public. She was a widow, didn't have a husband around to nag her about getting that thing off your forehead. So I'm just speculating, but that's what she did.
Now, is this a problem that still exists? I mean, are people still growing horns out of their foreheads?
Absolutely. Anybody can develop this, and it can be found in animals as well, cats and dogs. But as I say, it doesn't usually get that large.
Now, there's a plaster cast of Chang and Eng, the original Siamese twins.
Right.
How did the Mutter Museum get a plaster cast of the Siamese twins?
We had it made. And we had it made because we had just completed the autopsy on the Siamese twins in 1874. And that really was a great moment in the history of the college. These were internationally known men. And the question had always persisted from the first time they started going on public exhibit in 1829. Could they have been safely separated? And they would challenge the medical profession with that question. And it was a way of getting publicity. And finally, when the College of Physicians heard that they died, they realized this was an opportunity to answer that question. And they actually were able to get the families to agree to have the bodies brought to Philadelphia, and the autopsy was done in the Mutter Museum at its original location at 13th and Locust Streets. And after it was completed, that was when we had the cast made. We were allowed to keep their actual livers as well, because those were the only organs that were connected through that band.
So are their livers still on exhibit?
Absolutely, right below the cast.
And how are they preserved?
They're preserved right now in a 75% alcohol solution.
Huh. So Chang and Eng were joined by the abdomen.
It was actually at the end of the breastbone, there's a cartilage. And they were connected by that cartilage. So the band mostly consisted of skin and cartilage with superficial circulatory connections going along the very thin strip of liver tissue that actually passed through that band.
How did they die, and what did the Mutter Museum autopsy discover about whether they could have lived independent of each other?
They died because a few years before, 1874, Chang had suffered a stroke, and he was not in as good health as Eng, who was the larger, taller twin. And so it came to one night in January of 1874 when he was having trouble breathing and was obviously ill. But they had this routine. They had married sisters in North Carolina and had families of 21 children. But they set up separate households in adjacent farms, and every 3 days, like clockwork, they would travel from one man's farm to the other so that each man could be with his family, be the master of his estate, and then they would go. So it was a dark and stormy night, and they probably should not have gone because Chang was not well. But he insisted that they go to Aang's house, and during the night he died. And Eng woke up and found that his brother was dead, and roused the household, and they sent for the doctor, who had always said, if one dies, I will cut close to the body of the dead twin, and the other one should be able to survive. The doctor didn't come in time, and over the space of a few hours, Eng lapsed into a coma and died.
So did the autopsy find that they perhaps could have survived had they been separated earlier?
there is always that speculation that had it been done when they were children, when you have greater recuperative powers, it might have been successful. But they also discovered that in that band, unsuspected,
the band of muscle that
the band
that joined
of
them?
Skin and cartilage. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were slight outpouchings from each man's peritoneal cavity that contains their abdominal organs. So the band would have had to be very carefully dissected, because if you get into the peritoneum, then you can get massive abdominal infection. So the risk of infection was always there. And, of course, you're talking 1874. We're just beginning to use antiseptic surgical procedures. It's 20 years before x-rays. You really couldn't get an idea ahead of time what you'd find. It would have been just operating blind, so to speak. So the conclusion was that in the best of cases, they might have been surgically separated, but it probably would not have been advisable at any point because of the risk of shock and infection, and certainly more so when they were adult men.
One of the things on exhibit at the Motor Museum is a giant colon, a colon that grew to approximately five times the size of an average colon. What is the story behind this colon?
It belonged to a man who died in 1892. At age 29, and it's a congenital condition where you have a problem with the nerve supply to the muscular wall of the colon, so feces don't pass through normally, and you get backup of feces, and that's what caused the enlargement of the colon. Today we'd probably solve it by a colostomy or resection of the bowel, and they'd pick it up soon after, but we're talking the late 19th century. So it just got progressively larger as he grew, because at first he was able to function. He had various jobs as a messenger. And at one time he was actually on display at the famous dime museum at 9th and Arch Street as the windbag or balloon man. But as he got older, he was getting increasingly uncomfortable. So in 1892, we went to Hahnemann Medical College and complained to the doctors, and they correctly diagnosed it as an enlarged colon, but 1892, you weren't doing abdominal surgery that could have helped him in any way. So they took photographs, which we have on display at the museum with the colon, and then had to just send him away, and he died a few months later.
What did he look like?
He looked like a perfectly ordinary guy, about 5'7", a spare body, but with this enormously distended abdomen. And when they did the autopsy, they found that his abdominal organs were practically, you know, pushed up into his chest, up to his clavicle. So it must have been horribly uncomfortable.
So this colon is now preserved in what?
It was cleaned out, dried, and stuffed with a lot of excelsior, which is just wood shavings. We found old newspapers in it. I mean, it was a big thing to stuff. So they put in a lot of material. And it's important now because it's a spectacular example. Megacolons are fairly rare, and they just rarely get to that size. So it is still impressive, even from gastroenterologists today. And it makes it very clear how far medicine has progressed since 1892.
Gretchen Worden, director of the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. Worden died Monday at the age of 57. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry Gross's interview with Gretchen Worden, director of the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. Worden died Monday at the age of 57. The Mutter Museum is part of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia and was started in mid-19th century to teach medical students about deformities, disfigurements, and the effect of destructive diseases.
Now, the Mutter Museum was in its planning stages during the Civil War, and it actually opened at just about the time that the Civil War ended. Mm-hmm. And there are several very interesting displays within the exhibit that are documented in your new book of Civil War injuries, of medical instruments that were used to treat mm-hmm. soldiers during the Civil War. Let's talk about some of that a little bit. First of all, there were a lot of amputations during the war. How is that documented? Amputations of soldiers who needed, you know, had gangrene limbs or other wounds that required the limb be removed. What kind of documentation do you have of that in the museum?
The photographs you mentioned actually came from the Surgeon General's office. It's part of what they call the photographic series, and that was documenting Civil War wounds from about 1865 until about 1881. It's a magnificent document of photo document of the Civil War. And what they were able to do was, in some cases, document the initial operation, what the men looked like. And then as some of these soldiers would return to Washington to discuss pension disputes, for instance, they would be asked to go back to the Army Medical Museum where the photos had been taken, and you could do follow-ups. So you can actually see what procedures were successful and how well the men did as a result of amputations and some of the other operations. There's an idea that an awful lot or that too many operations, amputations, were done during the Civil War. But it, in some cases, the doctors have said that there weren't enough, because when you have a really severely damaged limb that is infected by the dirt, the clothing and whatnot, infection could kill the man. So the best thing to do is to remove the limb, create a clean surgical wound that will then heal naturally. And some doctors didn't want to amputate, would defer the decision from the field hospital to the general hospital. So by the time the guy had his amputation, it was sometimes too late. An infection had set in and they would die. So it was done, for the most part, appropriately.
And needless to say, this is before antibiotics. So
exactly.
You couldn't kill an infection with antibiotics then.
Yeah.
Well, you also have on display a Civil War medical kit. Talk about some of the instruments in that kit that we wouldn't see today.
Actually, you'd see most of them today. The only thing you wouldn't see is instruments with ebony handles, because now we know about sterilization. And to do either heat or chemical sterilization, you need an all-steel instrument. But the shape of the knives, the treffins, are almost exactly what you'll find in a modern amputating kit. And I've been told by some surgical departments that they still keep a case like this handy for use in amputations.
There's a little saw in there?
Yep, there's a saw. There's a saw for the skull. There's a saw for taking off big limbs. And a metacarpal saw for taking off fingers and toes.
Is that how it would be done today, with a saw like that?
They would probably use an electric saw. Not the old back and forth type.
Right.
But otherwise, yeah, sawing is the way you get through bone.
Was there any equivalent of anesthesia besides, you know, a good shot of alcohol?
Oh, absolutely. No. See, this is the other point that people forget about the Civil War. Anesthesia, ether, and chloroform had both been in use since the 1840s. By the time the Civil War came along, doctors were well experienced in using it. And they, for the most part, had good supplies all through the war. And so anesthesia was not a problem. They did have that.
What are some of the things that were learned about medicine as a result of treating all the war injuries?
A lot of the doctors did become more proficient in dealing with trauma wounds, because a lot of these doctors are coming from private practice where you did not see as many gunshot wounds and fractures. So they would improve their skills that way. There were advances made in plastic surgery, particularly because of a New York doctor, Dr. Gurdon Buck, who had a lot to work with in terms of some pretty awful face wounds, and made improvements there. The problem with the Civil War is it came just before the great breakthrough of Pasteur with the germ theory and Lister with the antisepsis. And so, whereas in a lot of wars you can look at all of the great leaps forward that have been made that then become part of the systematic practice of medicine, with the Civil War it's not so much that case. The great advance there was in the organizing of the Army Medical Corps and in evacuating wounded men from the field very quickly and getting them to field hospitals. because wars always catch the Army Medical Corps by surprise. And so they have to staff up very quickly by getting a lot of contract surgeons and enlisting men, and also having to set up a system of the hospitals and the ambulances. So that was the great advance, really, medically in the Civil War.
You say in the book that one of the most popular exhibits in the museum is a collection of more than 2,000 objects removed from the throats and airways of patients, such as? What are some of the things that have been removed from patients' throats?
Well, the collection came to us in 1924. So there's stuff in there that you're not going to see around today. Collar buttons, for example, very popular with kids. We also have a lot of hairpins and safety pins. And I speculate that, you know, maybe it was a mother holding the pin as she's diapering the baby. Today you'd have diaper tabs. That's a current choking hazard. You also get a lot of toys you don't see. Jacks, I don't know if kids play with jacks anymore, but they certainly aren't using skate keys, and those are some of the items. Plus, there's a lot of dental appliances. I think dentists are more careful now about removing loose prosthetics from the mouth before they go in. But there's a lot of that slipped down people's throats.
There's a really eerie image in there. I think it must be like an x-ray or something, of a throat with a little toy battleship stuck in it.
Yeah, it's an x-ray of a child, and we have the little metal battleship, and it was successfully removed. Dr. Chevalier Jackson was the physician who assembled the collection, and it was to be used as a teaching collection, because for each item, he has the complete case history, how old the patient was, where the object was, what it was, how long it had been in there, and what instrument was used to successfully remove it.
Gretchen Worden, the longtime director of the Mutter Museum of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. She died Monday after a brief illness at the age of 57. More of her interview in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Delacorte Press, publisher of Lucifer's Shadow by David Hewson, a novel of intrigue and art spanning three centuries in Venice, new in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Gretchen Worden, director of the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, where she worked for nearly 30 years. She died Monday. We also talked to one of her colleagues, Dr. Mark Hochberg. And David Edelstein reviews the new film, Collateral. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Gretchen Worden, the longtime director of the Mutter Museum of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. Worden died Monday at the age of 57. The museum was created in the 1860s as a teaching museum for doctors studying deformed and disfigured bodies and the impact of destructive diseases and trauma. Its collection includes wax models, photographs, and actual specimens. Terry spoke with Worden in 2002.
The Mutter Museum has a whole collection of fetuses stored in jars. What are some of the medical reasons for this collection?
Well, it's interesting. We just have redone that exhibit. It's called our teratology collection, and it's congenital abnormalities or birth defects. And it's important in the study of embryology and in the study of how the body develops normally. Oftentimes, it's only when something goes wrong that you're aware of how it should go right and at what point in the development. So it's a document of all the different things that can affect the development of the child. And it can be the internal environment. It can be things that the mother has ingested or is exposed to. It can be genetic. It can simply be a mutation in a gene. It can be caused by any number of environmental teratogens, and I think there are more of those today that can cause deformities. So it really gives us insight into the way human beings develop when you look at the anomalies.
And are most of these fetuses, were they mostly delivered or taken surgically from the mother's womb?
The older specimens would probably be either natural miscarriages or have been delivered normally. The more recent ones that we have with the severe anomalies are sometimes in pregnancies that have been terminated deliberately because the defect has been picked up on ultrasound or amniocentesis and the decision was made not to carry the pregnancy further.
Is this one of the exhibits that gets, like, the most emotional reaction from people? Or I'm wondering if it's even controversial among some people.
It really, surprisingly, hasn't engendered any controversy because we have it within the context of the whole Mutter Museum. We're an educational museum about medicine and human development. It's in a section where it segues smoothly into normal fetal development, conjoined twins. So because of that, people look at it as part of the whole display, which is why I don't sometimes like to have photographs of the fetuses taken and set apart from the rest of the environment. But people, of course, they're amazed sometimes to see some of these defects, and then they start reading the labels. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with all of the museum. Now, I get sometimes people react more strongly to the megacolon or to the swallowed objects. You never know what someone's going to identify with. They either have had a similar problem or they know someone with it. Some people can't get over that human horn.
Right. You know, one of the things that knocks me out, there's a couple of photographs that you've included in your Mutter Museum book of two women with lordosis, which is a severe curvature of the spine. And you know, like the trunk of their body is about 3 inches in front of the rear of their body, and the waist is just kind of flat, like flat and extended.
Yeah.
So like the behind is on one end of the waist, and then several inches in front of it is the torso. It's like there's a flat thing connecting them. I'm not sure if I'm describing this very clearly.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of thing where you look at it and you could say, that's how I feel some days. You know?
Well, that's the way I feel about the megacolon.
Right.
Yeah. I'm feeling bloaty.
Is that a typical reaction that people that personally relate to some of these anomalies? Because even though these anomalies are just very extreme disfigurements, that you kind of feel that way on a smaller level sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. As I say, it's you are struck by the fact that you're looking at human beings. And there, but for the grace of God, go I, you say oftentimes. And thank God for modern medicine.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's And, of course, the fact is a lot of what we look at in the museum and think, oh, my God, nobody has that today. All you have to do is go into a third world country or go into rural America and you will find these, you know, incredibly disfiguring disorders. We are so spoiled by the fact that we're living in a city that has been a center of medicine since the 18th century, and we've got the best here. But that's not the way the rest of the world lives.
What's one of the exhibits that we haven't yet mentioned that gets a very strong response from viewers?
I think that would be the Wall of Skulls. It's a collection of 139 skulls from the peoples of Eastern and Central Europe that we bought from a Viennese anatomist in 1874. And this type of collection was typical of 19th century medical museums. They would collect skulls of people from all over the world, and thousands of them, and have them on display, because the whole idea is compare and contrast, be able to look at all of the differences between the skulls, which you can only see when you see a large number together. And what's fascinating is that Professor Hurdle, from whom we bought it, was able to record, in most cases, the name, the age, the occupation, in some cases a religion, and the cause of death of each of these individuals. So you're not just looking at a skull for the shape, as an anthropologist would. You're looking in a life, and you're seeing just a little glimpse of what people were living like in mid-19th century Europe. You've got your guerrillas, you've got your deserters, your soldiers, you know, who, from one hand, they're bad people. On the other hand, they're freedom fighters. It all depends on which side you were of the politics. There's a mother who killed her child. There's a rope walker who died of a broken neck. It's wonderful from a sociological and cultural point of view. So you have this wall of skulls with this very cursory information, and you can look at it and just kind of imagine, if they had to summarize my life in four lines and write it on the side of my skull, what would they write? And we get that kind of reaction from people, too.
Gretchen Worden, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Gretchen Worden.
There's so many different ways to relate to the Motor Museum. One way is that, you know, it's fascinating medical history. It's a good teaching tool for doctors. Another is that it's just a kind of oddly beautiful representation of the human condition, all the things that could go astray with the physical part of the human condition. But another way of looking at it is it's just good, gross-out fun, right? And I'm sure a lot of people come to the Motor Museum for that reason, that it's good, gross-out kind of fun. How do you react when people come to the museum for that reason, to point and to laugh and giggle? And
well, I'll tell you, they may be drawn there out of curiosity.
Uh-huh.
Curiosity is a wonderful motivator. And possibly the curiosity is a little morbid. But once they walk into that space, they see the beautiful wooden cabinets and the rich colors of the carpet and the lighting, and then they start reading the labels and they're immediately sucked into the whole life of that individual and how it reflects back on your life. So you don't get a lot of poking and laughing. You'll get some comments like, hey, come over here, look at this. You won't believe it. But that's great. I mean, because it's wonderful to hear the interactions of people between themselves looking at these things. So whatever gets people in the door is fine, and curiosity brought me in that door.
Yeah?
27 years ago.
What was it that
ago.
Brought you in?
Well, actually, I happened to go to church next door from the time I was 8 years old. I had no idea what was in that building. Until I was going to Temple University studying anthropology and still singing in the church choir, and the guy who sang bass happened to be assistant to the curator at the museum, and he told me about it. I took me over to see the museum, and I said, if you ever leave this job, I want it. He left, I got it. So it was fascinating because when I was growing up in the Philadelphia area, you always heard about the museum that had babies in bottles. And you had to be a medical student to be able to see them, which, of course, was not true. And then to find out I've been going to church next door to that museum. It was fabulous.
Now, I understand you keep up with the tabloids to see what kind of medical anomalies, real and imagined, they are documenting. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. That's where you find most of the stories about Siamese twins, the real ones and the fake ones. And they have stringers all over the world. So sometimes you see something reported in a tabloid before it even hits the medical literature. And it also is a way of seeing how the public looks at these anomalies and the stuff that they will believe because they don't know any better. You know, Siamese triplets. I'm sorry. We will explain to you very carefully in our exhibits how Siamese triplets just don't happen.
Why not?
Well, it's because it's a single egg that splits in two, and it can't split again in three. Now, maybe you have some fusion going on, but no, you have to read the tabs with a little discretion. But see, that, again, points up an area where we can help to inform the public.
Well, Gretchen Worden, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Gretchen Worden, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. Worden was the director of the Mutter Museum of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. She died Monday at the age of 57. Dr. Mark Hochberg is CEO of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. He spoke to Terry yesterday about Gretchen Worden and her work at the Mutter Museum.
When you came to the College of Physicians to be its CEO, what did people tell you about the Mutter Museum and about Gretchen?
Terry, they didn't have to tell me anything. When you met Gretchen Worden, you were first thought you were meeting Jane Fonda, but then you realized there was a wonderful, warm personality with an incandescent 1,000-watt smile who just was immediately engaging. Gretchen had turned this museum into a magnificent museum that teenagers love. One of our greatest audiences is what Gretchen used to call sullen teenagers. Young people who couldn't be dragged to a museum for anything except the interesting medical objects and exhibits drew them to the museum in huge numbers.
Let me tell you a story. After I interviewed Gretchen, my niece, who was an occupational therapist, came and visited me in Philadelphia, and I took her to the Mutter Museum. And this was a couple of summers ago. I think it was about 2 years ago. And one of the exhibits is an arm with smallpox on it. And my attitude is just like a layperson was like, wow, that's really ugly. It's really scary. It's really fascinating. Like, whoa, look at those sores. And and her attitude was that as a medical professional, she was supposed to be getting her smallpox vaccination soon because of terrorist threats. And I thought, wow, that's just like one small example of the difference between how a layperson like me would react to this stuff and how a professional like her would react to it. And I'm just wondering, as you know, as the CEO of the medical college, what your reaction is to like the people like me who are just there to say, like, wow, that's really creepy, that's really interesting, that's really weird. It's not the medical professional approach. And I think one of the things from my perspective, one of the wonderful things Gretchen did with the museum was really to welcome people like me who just want to see the human body in all of its strange, mysterious ways, even the creepy ways.
Terry, when you tell me this story with your obvious interest and enthusiasm, my reaction is Gretchen still lives, because that's exactly what she hoped the viewers would take away. On a professional level, on a layman's level, she felt that these objects, a wax model of someone with smallpox, had innate interest and beauty and medical importance at many different levels. And Gretchen wrote in the beginning of her book on the Mutter Museum an introduction that said one of her goals was not only for the viewers or the visitors to look at all these objects, but the objects are also looking back at you, saying, what is your reaction? And by describing very different reactions to similar exhibits, Gretchen has achieved her goal, because she saw these innate objects as not only educational tools, but also a certain amount of beauty.
When she got sick, and I don't know whether you can answer this, and if you can, whether you'd feel comfortable answering this, but when she got sick, how she felt about the rebellion of her own body. You know, it's one thing to be an outside party looking at deformity or at the body in a state of rebellion, and it's another thing to experience that and to be trapped inside that body that is rebelling against you. How did she deal with that?
That's a great question. Gretchen was an ebullient personality, but the answer to that question you could only sort of read in her reaction. And her reaction to her illness was to say, my responsibilities to my museum. She was literally at her post last week at the museum, despite being clearly very ill. I think that her view is that illness and deformity is not an embarrassing, ugly thing. It's part of the human condition. And to some extent, I think she was able to cope with her own final illness with a certain amount of strength from the fact that this is the normal turn of events. It's not ugly. This is not to be something to be swept under the carpet or to be embarrassed about. And she was very, very proud of the fact that, for example, we have the plaster cast mold of the death mold of Cheng and Eng, the Siamese twins. And right below the plaster cast of their death mold is their conjoined liver, the liver where they were joined. That's why they came from Siam, and so that's why it became known as Siamese twins as opposed to French twins or Australian twins. And she would understand what it was like to live as a conjoined twin, because she actually reached out to conjoined twins in America and got to know them and got to be their friends, invited them into the museum. And the first, I believe, separation of conjoined twins, or one of the first, was by a fellow of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, C. Everett Koop, who went on to do wonderful other things. And Dr. Koop really pioneered this. And so Gretchen and Dr. Koop had this incredible relationship where she would help conjoined twins understand what it was like from other conjoined twins. Her friendships are only now becoming known to us. We knew that she was an important person in Philadelphia, that she had a lot of friends throughout the cultural environment. But the letters and calls we've been getting are amazing. For example, she was a good friend of David Letterman's, and David Letterman
really?
Had her on his show three times. Now, I guess if you're being on David Letterman's show once is not such a big deal, because if you're only there once and you don't get invited back, I guess he considers you a dud. He kept calling, kept asking her to come back. So how did she react to her final illness? I think she was proud to join the long line of patients who understood, suffered, but ultimately were ennobled by their disease.
What happens to the museum now?
This is still a very difficult and tender time for the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. Gretchen is virtually our longest-standing employee. Again, she was there almost 30 years. But I think that her legacy will be that the museum will continue. Will continue to thrive, and we believe she set it on a course that will continue for decades. The most touching tribute in terms of generation to generation is I noticed this today, a bouquet of flowers that arrived at the college, and you know, as you might expect at the time of death, we get a number of bouquets of flowers, but I happened to notice the card. And I was stunned when I read the card. The card read, "In memory of Gretchen Worden, from the descendants of Cheng and Eng, the Siamese twins, who made our great-grandparents come alive for us.
Wow.
I mean, that is powerful to know that she reached out to the great-grandchildren of the Siamese twins. And, of course, none of us had any knowledge of that. But this is the kind of person who we are deeply grieving.
Dr. Hochberg, thank you so much. And I'm just really sorry, you know, about her death.
Terry, you're very kind to replay her interview so we can all, again, hear her wonderful voice and the wonderful impact she's had on visitors to the museum and your listeners.
Dr. Mark Hochberg, Chief Executive Officer of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, speaking to Terry Gross. A memorial service for Gretchen Worden will be held at the College of Physicians of Philadelphia on Sunday, September 12th. Coming up, a review of the new film Collateral. This is Fresh Air. Michael Mann's new action thriller, Collateral, stars Tom Cruise as a hired killer with salt-and-pepper hair. Jamie Foxx co-stars as Max, an unwilling L.A. cabbie who's forced to drive Cruise from one victim to the next. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
One of my favorite scenes in Taxi Driver is when Robert De Niro's Travis Bickle seeks out a philosophical cabbie called the Wizard, played by Peter Boyle, to come to terms with his spiritual dislocation. The Wizard says, "Look, a man takes a job, and that becomes what he is." And he rambles on in blue-collar existential mode for a while, and then Travis says, "I don't know, that's about the dumbest thing I've ever heard." I think of that exchange, both halves, when I see a Michael Mann film like Thief or Heat or The New Collateral, because Mann is the American crime genre's most wizard-like existential philosopher of machismo. In movie after movie, he asks, "What is a man? A thief, a cop, an assassin. That's what he does. Is that what he is? Is he free to choose? Or does a man gotta do what a man's gotta do?" Well, Michael Mann's gotta do what Michael Mann's gotta do. And that's give these philosophical conundrums a throbbing backbeat and famously moody visuals. Men's fashion magazines have followed this director ever since Miami Vice, the way he frames his characters to bring out both their alienation and their glamour. It makes you think, "That is God's loneliest man. And where can I get that suit?" There are two lonely men in Collateral. Max, played by Jamie Foxx, is an L.A. cabbie. He wants to own a fleet of limos, but in the meantime, he brings to his taxi driver role a superhuman focus. He makes that taxi gleam, and when he picks up a fetching lawyer, played by Jada Pinkett Smith, he estimates her travel time to the minute. His next passenger is Vincent, played by Tom Cruise, a hired killer who's every bit the perfectionist Max is. The universe has been cruel to him, and everywhere he looks, he sees signs of its cruelty to others. If you think I'm reading these highbrow themes into the movie, listen to this.
We're in Plan B. Still breathing? Now we gotta make the best of it. Improvise, adapt to the environment, Darwin. It happens, I Ching, whatever, man, we gotta roll with it.
I Ching, what are you talking about, man? You threw a man out of the window.
I didn't throw him. He fell.
But what did he do to you?
What?
What did he do to you?
Nothing. I only met him tonight.
You just met him once and you kill him like that?
What, I should only kill people after I get to know them?
No.
Max, 6 billion people on the planet, you're getting bent out of shape because of one fat guy.
Well, who was he?
What do you care? Have you ever heard of Rwanda?
Yes, I know Rwanda.
Well, tens of thousands killed before sundown. Nobody's killed people that fast since Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Did you bat an eye, Max?
What?
Did you join Amnesty International, Oxfam, Save the Whale, Greenpeace, or something? No. I offer one fat Angelino and you throw a hissy fit.
Man, I don't know any Rwandans.
You don't know the guy that drunk either.
The dialogue in context is ridiculous, and Collateral is so over-designed that in one scene the gas pumps are color-coordinated with the cab. But the first half is magical anyway. It's lyrical and jazz-inflected, and man can make the flare of a streetlight, the reflection of the cab in a mirrored building, even the curve of a windshield, seem expressive. Visually, this is a city boulevard symphony, and the script by Stuart Beattie is black farce, teasing and cruel. Max is the voice of humanity. He says the people you're killing are somebody's friends, and Vincent replies, in essence, that we're all alone. Max is right, but Vincent is cooler, with samurai-like moves. He even saves Max's life. So for a while, neither character has the dramatic edge. But in the second half, Collateral turns into a series of action set pieces that are completely over the top. And existentialist though he may be, man is lousy at action. His framing is too fancy, and he doesn't give you your bearings. So most of the time, you have no idea where people are in relation to one another, or even who just got shot. The need to up the ante becomes ludicrous. Vincent turns into the Terminator, so dedicated to his role, he doesn't care if he kills everyone in the city. And Max has to prove that commitment to other people isn't just morally superior to nihilism, it makes you a better marksman, too. It's lucky that Jamie Foxx gives a terrific performance. The tension between nervous deliberator and action hero is funny and, against all odds, believable. But Tom Cruise, he isn't believable for a second. It's fun to see him with salt and pepper hair in a role where he can't flash that trademark smile. But he overacts not smiling. His robotic performance makes Collateral seem like the reductio ad absurdum of a Michael Mann movie, like dancing menstorm mannequins spouting being and nothingness. I felt like Travis Bickle saying, I don't know, man. That's about the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Nonesuch Records, featuring Hymns of the 49th Parallel, the new album by Katie Lang, a tribute to Canadian songwriters Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, and five others. It's available at Barnes & Noble Music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the life of a Colombian drug mole. We'll meet the makers of the new film Maria Full of Grace. Director Josh Marston and actor-producer Orlando Tabone recreate a young girl's harrowing journey from Colombia to New York City filled with pellets of narcotics. Join us for the next Fresh Air.